Could the tone or intensity of your voice be a barometer of your mental health? What about how often you leave your home, or how much time you spend on the phone or sending text messages? Doctors at Brigham and Women's Hospital are testing out an app that tracks such elements to figure out what it can tell them about patients with anxiety or depression. WBUR's Martha Biebinger reports on what the technology could do.
Most days, often around lunchtime, Marcia Chesterfield finds a quiet spot where, for a few minutes, she won't be overheard. Today, against the wall of a lobby in the hospital where Chesterfield is a lead lab assistant, she pulls out her phone.
I'm already logged in. Let me see. So it's right here on my app. It says leave new check-in.
Chesterfield hits a red button and records a sort of audio diary.
So today is my mom's birthday. She passed away 2 years ago. I just wanted to say a little something and let her know that everything's okay. And otherwise than that, today is a really good day.
In a few seconds, Chesterfield has what she says is proof she's having a good day, following months of anxiety and depression triggered by a series of deaths in the family.
Hey, we got an in-between happy face.
Chesterfield is testing an app called Companion, developed by Boston-based Cogito, a company spawned at MIT's Media Lab. The app scores Chesterfield's mental well-being on a scale of 0 to 100 every day in four different ways. Its unique feature is this analysis of the tone, pace, and tension in Chesterfield's voice recording. The app also looks at how often Chesterfield calls or texts friends. A third measure determines how energized she is. And the out and about category uses GPS to track how often Chesterfield leaves her home and how far she goes. Her social worker, Laura Sullivan, reviews Chesterfield's scores on a computer screen, looking for patterns.
So, for instance, if this person is always a 98, 99, and now they suddenly become a 20, the question is sort of what happened.
Sullivan calls patients with the app between appointments to find out.
Historically, we would never know.
Because a counselor who sees a patient once a week or every other week only knows what the patient remembers or chooses to talk about. But with the app, Sullivan sees Chesterfield's mood and activity scores rise and fall daily.
I can watch this and then say, so I noticed during this time period, things changed for you. What does that mean? What was going on? And sometimes it makes the conversation deeper. It's a richer conversation.
The app does not show where Chesterfield goes when she leaves home or who she's texting. But still, some patients might not want to be tracked this closely. Chesterfield does.
Prior to this app, I would see myself outside my body. Like, it was just so much built up, and I just didn't have any way to release and know that somebody's on the other end monitoring. And it just feels good to have somebody doing that.
But is all the data patients send in useful? And will it improve a patient's mental health?
We want to make sure the research is being done to demonstrate the value.
David Ahern, a psychologist, leads the study of this app at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Ahern says apps may free up clinicians to handle more patients who need therapy and make patients better monitors of their own mental health.
This could be where, you know, you see a clinician on a much less frequent schedule because you have basically a clinician in your pocket.
It's misguided.
Dr. Jonathan Shedler, an associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, bristles at the idea that an app should be seen as even a partial substitute for talk therapy.
Every time you try to take the therapist out of the picture, what we know is that it actually doesn't work.
But supporters of technology point out there are many patients who will not go see a doctor or therapist, but will look for help on their phones. There are some concerns that directing patients to their phones could increase social isolation or addiction to technology. But Hannah Rubin, a manager at Cogito, says the Companion app is a response to that concern.
Because this technology is so ubiquitous and it's in so many people's hands already for health purposes, what we want to do is provide a validated way for people to find health information and to find it specific to them.
So can this app or one of the thousands of others coming to the market with the promise of improved mental well-being deliver? The results of the Brigham study, just one piece of the answer to that question, are 2 or 3 years away. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.
As researchers try to figure out which apps actually work, developers are already flooding the market. Dr. John Torres of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center chairs an American Psychiatric Association task force charged with helping clinicians evaluate all these mental health apps.
It's very hard to give a static rating to these apps to say this one is a 99%, this one is an A+, because they change every 2 weeks. What we've been focusing on at the American Psychiatric Association is, can we create checklists and workflows that make people ask all the right questions? They look at, what is the privacy of this app? What happens to data I give it? Is it sold? Do I keep it? Who controls it? Is my data traded?
Is there at least a reliable minimal certification for medical apps?
As long as an app poses minimal risk and doesn't act as what they call a health device, like, say, a pacemaker, the FDA really is not regulating these apps. Anyone can probably put up a health app. You can make claims that are not backed up or substantiated. It makes it a very tricky space.
And are there people out there doing that kind of thing?
There was a paper that some folks did in Australia. They looked at apps for bipolar disorder. One of the apps recommended that folks drink hard alcohol when they were having trouble sleeping. Another app recommended that folks avoid contact with family members because bipolar could be spread by, quote, your negative attitude, which is completely false, completely wrong.
Well, and kind of dangerous, too.
Oh, and very dangerous, exactly. The subtler damage also happens if you're downloading apps for, say, therapy or self-help and you don't get better. You may think, wow, I'm hopeless, my case can't get better, I'm treatment refractory. And it may just be used an app that was complete gibberish.
You said in one article that apps could lead to a paradigm shift in mental health care. What did you mean by that?
We've been talking a lot about the current risks and barriers, and I think there's a lot of exciting potential in what these apps could do if done right, if validated in a clinical and scientific manner. What's most interesting for mental health is phones can capture a lot of behavioral information that may be very relevant to mental health and psychiatry. A lot of the way that we collect symptoms in mental health is we ask patients questions. We say, how are you feeling? How are you sleeping? How active were you? And these are things that our phones may be inherently picking up. And if you bring in, we could offer people real-time surveys. We could get physiological information such as heart rate. This whole wealth of new data could help us better quantify different mental illnesses. And what makes it especially exciting is these phones can also offer adjuvant services. We can do telepsychiatry visits via the phone. We can do automated self-help therapy programs, can deliver help via the phone. We can send people useful reminders. It's a beautiful potential. There's a lot of things we have to do before we get there.
So is it your hope that someday mental health professionals might be able to monitor patients through apps so that you can see when a patient might be veering off course and might be nearing a situation where they could have some sort of a breakdown or some other issue?
Exactly. I think for the right patients and the right clinicians who want to use these tools, it could be a very effective, affordable, scalable, and soon hopefully evidence-based treatment.
But it does feel like it could be a little big brotherish.
It certainly could be. That's one of the reasons why this isn't taking off right now and it's not mainstream. I think we have to first look at what are the barriers, especially what are the security and privacy concerns right now, and how do we create standards that everyone knows what's being recorded, what's being shared, who does the information go to.
Dr. John Torres, psychiatrist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, thanks a lot for coming in. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Look at that smile.
I know. The brakes definitely work, so that's
good.
They're
tight, right?
Yeah, they're very tight, yeah.
That is WBUR producer Cassandra Sunt trying out a new type of bicycle designed here in Boston. The company is called Fortified Bicycles, an appropriate name given the goal to build rugged bikes that can take the bumps and bruises of being ridden around in cities. In short, urban bicycles. They're tough-looking, weatherproof, aluminum-framed with puncture-resistant tires and come in 1-speed or 8-speed. And the company claims that bike parts are locked down with theft-proof bolts and cannot be stolen. The bike is called the Invincible. At the company's headquarters in Chinatown, Fortified President Tivana Moore told us where the idea for this bike came from.
We started when a friend of ours got hit by a car when he was riding at night. The reason he got hit was because he didn't have any lights on his bike. And it wasn't because he was being irresponsible, but it was because the lights had actually been stolen earlier that night. And so we looked into it and we started asking ourselves, is this an isolated problem or is this something that people are actually experiencing while riding in the roads? And it turned out 1 in 3 city cyclists have their lights stolen, and 80% of cyclists forget their lights at home and at work because they're frequently taking them off trying to avoid theft.
So you started by making a headlight, and you've expanded since then.
Yep.
All right, so telescoping to today, on the floor outside of the room where we're chatting, you have a couple of bicycles. They're your product, the full bike called the Invincible.
That's right. What's
the inspiration?
So the idea was, having talked to hundreds of cyclists who were riding beaters, as we call them, essentially ugly bikes that they don't invest any money into because they're afraid that they're going to get picked apart or stolen or frequently have to maintain, people were saying, you know, it'd be great if I could have the convenience of a beater without the aesthetic downside of it and without having to worry about things getting stolen on it or getting flat tires or it rusting all the time. So out of that, we boiled that down to a few key features that the product needed to have. And when we put it all together, it was a pretty tough bike. So we thought the name Invincible was appropriate.
What makes this bike different than everything else or anything else that's on the market?
So aside from the fact that we've designed all the individual components to survive in the city, we also offer this service. It's called Fortified Theft Protection. And what it essentially does is, if any of the components or the bike itself is stolen, we ship you a new one within 24 hours.
So you've designed the bike so you can't steal the components, you can't steal the seat.
There is a small chance, but because we've designed these in-house and they are custom, it's a very, very small chance, and we're willing to put our name behind it.
So the pre-orders have finally turned into bikes that people will be riding on the streets of Boston.
Magically.
Kind of exciting for you, I must imagine.
Very, very exciting. I think the most exciting thing is I'm starting to get text messages from friends now saying, I saw one of your bikes.
So what happens if a bike is stolen? What's the process?
So the process starts with the customer reporting it to their local authorities. And then we verify with the local authorities to make sure that there actually was a theft that took place. And then once we've sufficiently verified that, we ship the customer a bike immediately and leaves our warehouse within 24 hours.
But so far, no thefts.
No theft.
So let me put my glasses on so that I can just take a look at one of these bolts that are custom designed and either non-breakable or at least very hard to do that. Is this one of them here?
Yes.
It's almost like a five-petal design. It sort of looks like a little flower inside.
Looks can be deceiving. It looks like a flower, but it's certainly much tougher than that. The way that we came to this design was actually iterating on about 30 different designs and using different tools that the average bike thief would use to try and get at them. And this performs better than most of them. Now, this isn't actually our only design. We have several different variations that we roll out in different production runs to make sure there is not one single key that's floating out there.
Okay. To make it even harder.
To make it harder.
Is Boston almost like the perfect city for you to launch this?
We've got the rain, we've got the snow, we've got what a lot of places all over the country are going to have. So by designing a bike that is tough enough to survive in Boston, we've essentially designed a bike that's tough enough to survive anywhere.
You don't need to go to a test track, you have your test track.
That's exactly right.
Tivan Amor is president of Fortified Bikes in Chinatown. Working directly with customers, the company expects to sell 1,000 of its new bikes this year. Find this Bostonomic story and others about innovation in the Boston economy at our website, WBUR.org. A heads up at this moment, this is coming from your radio, not outside your home.
Very clean. No parking on lot number 5. Will be taxed.
No parking on the odd-numbered side. You'll be tagged and towed. If you live in Cambridge, you've likely heard that announcement over and over and over, coming from city vehicles driving by your windows. It's an early morning reminder for residents to move their cars off the street for sweeping. WBUR's Ben Swayze went looking for the story behind that voice.
I climbed two steps into a huge dump truck, my ride for the morning.
Bill Hannafin. I do street cleaning and graffiti removal.
Hannafin wears a ball cap and a bright green reflective vest over a jacket. The amicable 62-year-old grew up in Cambridge and has worked for its Department of Public Works for 10 years. On this morning, he's driving an announcement truck. And he's ready to roll.
See when we get out of here.
We maneuver through the parking lot of Orange City Vehicles, and when we reach Zone B near MIT, our area for this first Monday of the month, Hannafin turns on the CD player. The voice comes from a speaker.
Street cleaning. No parking. Lot number side. Will be tagged and towed. Street cleaning. No parking on the lot number side. Will be tagged and towed.
We ride for about 20 minutes, the recording playing the whole time. Hannafin says hello to guys driving the wreckers, that's the tow trucks, and we stop for some Dunkin' coffee. We also get a few confused stares from onlookers.
Like this guy right here looking at us like, what's going on? He took his earphones out to listen. That's funny. That is funny. I don't think they know if you're actually, that's your voice on a microphone or if it's a tape, because they're just looking at you like, why are you doing that? You know, it's like, well, maybe they don't drive cars and they just drive bikes. They have no idea. You know, there's a lot of people around don't drive cars. Quite a few.
When street cleaning is going on, about 40 cars a day are towed throughout Cambridge. The city says the towing is an unwanted but necessary step to get to the curb. Hence, the courtesy announcement. An official told me he believes Cambridge is the only community in the area to do so. The announcement itself started in the 70s when street sweeping began. At first, it was indeed a city worker speaking into a loudspeaker.
We had some guy driving around speaking into the loudspeaker.
That didn't go so well, says Lenny Silva, who heads street sweeping.
Gets pretty tiring after maybe four or five streets. You'd not really be able to make him out too good. You know, he's mumbling after four or five streets.
Silva has worked for the DPW for 44 years. About 15 years ago, he proposed replacing the loudspeaker system with a taped message. So they went to those trained talkers at the 911 dispatch.
Hector Perez is over there, and he came up with the winning voice.
My name is Hector Perez. I'm a emergency dispatcher in Cambridge for the Emergency Communications Department.
And you are the voice of street sweeping in Cambridge.
That's correct. I was recorded 15 years ago to make the announcement.
And here's the thing. Perez, who lives in Milton, says he's never heard the announcement. A family friend heard it one morning and said she thought she was losing her mind until he confirmed it was indeed his voice. And then there's this.
I have to handle the calls for people looking for their cars after they're being street cleaned. And I'm always afraid that they're going to recognize my voice. Because they'll say, you know, generically, you know, you towed my car, or, you know, you people towed my car. But in this case, you know, yes, I actually told you I was going to tow your car. And I did it. So I have to actually do my telephone voice and, you know, talk a little softer. And no, don't recognize me. I'm just a voice behind the phone. No, I'll find your car right away. Just give me a few minutes.
So there you have it. The voice behind the tow. Just don't blame him for your tow.
Can you humor me and do the street sweeping announcement?
Street cleaning. No parking on the even-numbered side. You will be tagged and towed.
Is that what I say?
That is what you say.
For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Ben Swayze.
The July 4th holiday weekend is upon us. Yay! And it looks like it's going to be pretty nice weather-wise. Joining us this morning via Skype to talk about it is WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bob. Happy July 4th weekend.
And the same to you. So first of all, in the Boston area, what's it going to be like?
Well, all weekend's going to be really nice. Lots of sunshine. And it's really not going to matter whether you're on Cape Cod or in northern Maine, just wall-to-wall sunshine. Now, the one exception is the showers we have moving in this afternoon and more likely during the middle part of the evening for eastern Massachusetts.
Well, tell us about that.
Okay, so we have a cold front which is moving off towards the east today, and it will pass through the area overnight tonight and early Saturday morning. That's going to kick off some showers and perhaps some thunderstorms. They'll first enter western New England after 4 o'clock this afternoon and make it to the coastline somewhere between 8 o'clock and midnight tonight.
And after that, it's beautiful.
After that, it's beautiful. There's actually no more chances of rain for at least another week, which, of course, isn't good because we are in a drought.
What about the all-important 4th of July festivities? Will all the parades, cookouts, and fireworks pretty much be a go, as near as we can tell?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in some ways, I'm feeling like my job isn't really necessary this summer. It just keeps being this wall-to-wall sunshine with dry weather and no chance of rain. And that's really what we have for the 4th. You know, you look back at some 4ths, like the hot one, July 1911, it was 104 in Boston, actually the warmest record in the record books for Boston. And this year, it's just going to be in the 80s, low levels of humidity, nice sunshine. It's not going to be one of those weekends where we really have to worry about heat exhaustion and all those things.
I take it if you're heading for the North or South Shore or the Cape Ann, the islands this weekend, it's going to be great beach weather.
Yeah, it is going to be nice beach weather. Water temperatures are beginning to come up a little bit now, getting well into the 60s, and some of the coves where the water tends to be a little bit warmer could be approaching 70 degrees by the end of the weekend. High tide this weekend runs from about 10:30 to 11:30 in the morning. It's a fairly high tide, which means there'll be a little bit less sand than some of the other high tides you have during the course of the month.
And what about if you're spending your weekend in the mountains, either in the Berkshires or up in New Hampshire or up in Maine?
Lots of sunshine. Obviously, the higher you go, the cooler it's going to be. If you're atop Mount Washington, temperatures will be, you know, around 50 degrees. But most people will be camping at night. Temperatures generally in the upper 40s to mid 50s, depending on exactly where you're going to be. Great sleeping weather for camping. Great hiking weather. Bring the sunscreen. The sun is incredibly strong this time of the year, and the strength of the sun can really burn you in as little as 15 to 25 minutes.
Is there any good soaking rain in the long-term forecast?
Not that I can see. And as a matter of fact, it wouldn't surprise me if we have to wait all the way until sometime in late August or during the month of September before we see some of those tropical showers come in, perhaps with a tropical system or something like that. So I think that we talked about this way back in the middle of the winter. It just didn't have much precipitation. We've been below average now for many, many months if you go all the way back to last year. So we're really in a New England drought. It's not a California drought, but it's a New England drought, and I just don't see any break in this pattern at all.
WBUR meteorologist David Epstein, thanks a lot. And again, have a very nice holiday weekend, David.
You as well.